Well, good morning. Let's go ahead and get started.
As I knock everything on the floor here.
I'm David Pumphrey with the senior fellow here with the Energy and National Security Program. And it's really a great pleasure to have ExxonMobil here to do their long-term outlook. And it's interesting that it comes at a time that the IEA just came through with their latest WEO outlook. So in many ways, we can go ahead and pull out our WEO outlooks and lay them side by side and say, okay, now how do you guys measure up? But we'll see. But this morning, we've got Bill Colton, who's the Vice President for Corporate Strategic Planning, and Ken Cohen, Vice President of Public and Government Affairs, here to do this presentation. I think we'll not do the usual obligatory going around the room because we're on a fairly tight schedule. I think we've got about an hour for the presentation. Is that about right, Ken? So
yes.
We can do that. We do have people on the line. I'm not sure how many are listening in.
Over
100 listening in. So I think that as we move into the question and answer period, be sure to use your microphones so that those who are online can listen in and hear what's being said. And then when we do go into question period, that'll be the point in time to introduce yourself and your affiliation so that you will know who's here in the room asking a question. So without any further ado, Ken, do you want to go ahead and get started?
Thanks, David, and thanks everyone for joining, and thanks to all of you who are online with us. It makes the room seem quite large now with over 100 people. Before we start, make the following comment that the outlook contains forward-looking statements. Actual future conditions, including economic conditions, energy demand, and energy supply, could differ materially due to changes in technology, the development of new supply sources, political events, demographic changes, and other factors discussed in the report and by Bill. And in the information provided includes ExxonMobil's internal estimates and forecasts based upon internal data and analyses, as well as publicly available information from external sources, including the International Energy Agency. I sound like a pharmaceutical commercial. And there'll be no tests on this. Now, I'm going to hand it over to Bill. Bill will have about 20, 25 minutes of prepared remarks, and then the two of us will be happy to answer any questions on the material that Bill's covering or energy policy matters that are certainly front and center right now. So with that, Bill?
All right. Thanks, Ken, and good morning. I'm delighted to see all of you here today to discuss our new outlook for energy, which we're releasing to the public just today. This year, for the first time, we look out to the year 2040. We'll discuss how much energy the world will need then and what kinds of energy are going to make the most sense to fuel economic growth and to support global development at our modern living standards and continue to improve environmental performance. At ExxonMobil, the outlook provides the foundation for our own business strategies and our investment decisions, so we have every incentive to get it right. Now, as I think everyone in this room knows, energy remains a hot topic. Citizens and policymakers around the world have many questions, such as how do renewables and new technologies fit into the energy picture? Can we move to cleaner fuels? And what can policymakers do to help achieve a better energy future for everyone? Now, most people don't think too much about energy. We understand that, and especially in the developed world. Energy just seems to be there in the background, always working for us. When we turn on the gas for cooking or plug in our cell phone to charge it, we just expect the energy to flow, and it does. Consumers don't have to worry too much about what happens behind the scenes, so to speak, to build the power plants, the transmission lines, the pipelines, and energy development facilities that make our modern life possible. So those of us who work in the industry, I have to say, take some pride in being able to deliver energy so reliably and safely that most people don't have to think much about it. At the same time, however, let me assure you that meeting the world's growing demands for energy is an enormous undertaking. The scale of the energy business is immense. Every hour, 24 hours a day, the world uses 450 million gallons of fuel. And at ExxonMobil, every single one of us, men and women who come to work every day for the company, are focused on meeting the needs of consumers and society worldwide, and we're just a small part of the huge energy industry as millions of others join us in this mission to deliver the world's energy needs. Now, as Ken has mentioned, I'm going to spend probably the half of the time, maybe 20, 25 minutes with the presentation, but we'll open it up at the end for questions, so there should be plenty of time for that. Now, we start with two key drivers of global development, the growth and the number of people, shown on the left here, and economic output in the middle. Growth rates are shown at the top. Today, the near-term prospects for the global economy may appear uncertain and concerning. We understand that. But when we look to the long term, over the next 30 years, we believe that the world will continue to enjoy economic growth around the globe. And this is largely driven by global rapid developments in living standards in places like China and India, as well as Africa and Latin America. Now, as growing populations advance economically and seek better living standards, energy use inevitably increases. ExxonMobil expects that the world will need 30% more energy in the year 2040 than in 2010. Now, note, however, looking at the chart, you can see that the pace of growth is much lower in energy than in economic activity. And how do we achieve this? And the answer is efficiency. We expect that continuing improvements in technology will allow reduced energy consumption per unit of GDP. And just to emphasize this efficiency point, if you look at this yellow line, it shows how much more energy the world would need if we had no improvements in efficiency. So the storyline here at a high level, this chart kind of tells the whole story, and that as the world population expands and living standards improve, the world will need more energy even as we learn to use energy more efficiently. Now, a fundamental driver of economic growth and energy demand is a population's demographics. In key areas like the OECD and China, we expect that slowing population growth, coupled with efficiency gains, will lead to a slowdown in energy demand over time. Now, here we show OECD population in the developed world beginning to plateau around 2040, as relatively low birth rates and other factors combine to produce a rising percentage of older citizens. Now, let's look at China. China's population is expected to peak in 2030 at about 1.4 billion people. However, as a result of smaller family sizes, China's working age population is projected to peak much earlier, likely within the next 10 years. This trend will slow China's growth and their energy demand. Next, we see India. India will become the world's most populous country after 2030. But unlike China, its working age population will continue to grow, and this will support continued economic expansion for India. Africa shows even bigger population growth and a large percentage of working age people. Even with these demographic advantages, however, we do not see India and Africa achieving the same kind of boom that China has experienced over the past several decades, largely because Africa, and to a lesser extent India, lacks some of the features that enabled China to achieve that growth, high levels of investment and education levels. Now, looking at these charts, we see the challenge that lies ahead. People everywhere seek improved living standards, and their numbers are growing. So the question is, how do we continue to supply the energy that enables both economic and social development, and to do so safely, reliably, and affordably? Now, when we talk about demand, we're going to talk about these four primary sectors: residential, commercial, transportation, industrial, and electricity generation. We show for each of these four sectors, each with a different color, the demand in 2010, 2025, and 2040. And as you can see, electricity generation is the largest and fastest growing sector. It's the most popular form of energy for consumers. Transportation and industrial demand continue to grow, while residential commercial is relatively flat. Now, as we talk about these sectors, I'd like to start with transportation. Transportation is one of the most familiar and prominent sectors in energy, and it's the one that has the biggest influence on oil demand through 2040. That's because right now, nearly all of the world's transportation is powered by oil products. Liquid fuels are so prevalent because small volumes at affordable prices provide lots of energy, making them easy to transport and widely available. This issue of energy density is very, very important just to understand how valuable liquid fuels are for transportation. And just to emphasize this point, I want you to think about the energy concentrated in just 1 gallon of gasoline. The energy in 1 gallon of gasoline has enough energy to recharge an iPhone every night for almost 20 years. Now, when we think about transportation, most of us think of cars. But there's a reason why this photograph shows 18-wheelers, as you're about to see. Take a look at this slide. On the left, you see our projected demand for commercial forms of transportation. This is mostly trucks, but also airplanes, ships, and trains. On the right, you see our outlook for energy demand for light-duty vehicles. This is cars, SUVs, and the small pickup trucks, really basically the personal vehicles that people drive in their everyday lives. Now, as you can see, demand for commercial transportation, or trucks on the left, rises steadily, while demand for personal vehicles actually plateaus fairly soon and then begins a gradual decline. Now, why is this? Continued economic activity will drive commercial demand, shown here on the left, and basically it just links very closely to the growth in world GDP, which almost doubles over this period. But the big story here is in personal vehicles. While ExxonMobil expects that the number of personal vehicles in the world, the global fleet, so to speak, will continue to climb, the effect of this increase on fuel demand will be offset by two things. The biggest factor is our expectation that by 2040, personal vehicles will have much higher fuel economy than they do today. The other factor, to a lesser extent, is we expect the average miles traveled per vehicle will be lower. Now, let's look at this further. ExxonMobil expects that the cars we drive in 2040 will be highly evolved from the cars we drive today. Mainly, they'll be more efficient. As you can see on the left, we expect global light-duty vehicle fleet to reach about 1.5 billion vehicles. This is consistent with expanding prosperity around the world. Not surprisingly, nearly all of this growth will come from China and the rest of the non-OECD, where personal incomes are rising and where car ownership rates today are relatively low. But now let's look at some of the changes coming in the composition of the global fleet. We expect that by 2040, hybrids will account for 40% of all light-duty vehicles on the road, compared to less than 1% today. To a large extent, the changes in the fleet will be driven by government policies designed to improve fuel economy. Conventional gasoline vehicles will also become far more fuel efficient over the coming decades, but that technology alone is unlikely to be able to meet the government targets. Now, as you can see on the chart, electric vehicles and plug-in hybrid vehicles, which are PHV and EV on the chart, will grow to only about 5% of the fleet by 2040. And their gains, in our view, will be limited by the fact that they will remain much more expensive and less convenient for consumers. Hybrids, we believe, will make much more sense for consumers. In a way, they combine the best of both technologies. You have the advantages, the convenience, and affordability of conventional liquid fuels, but also the efficiencies that come with electric motors. Now, how many miles per gallon do we think a car will get in the year 2040? This shows our estimates for several countries. The top of the blue bar shows the expected mileage for new cars in various parts of the world, and the dashed lines show today's level. As you can see, personal vehicles will become much more fuel efficient. For example, in the U.S., we expect average new car fuel efficiency to rise to about 45 miles per gallon, and that compares with only 22 today. Now, also on this chart, we show the government targets. The red dots or diamonds show 2015 targets, and the gold diamonds are for later periods. And now we come to the largest energy demand sector, which is electricity, electricity generation. It's perhaps easiest to take electricity for granted because it's invisible and instantly available to consumers at the flip of a switch. And demand for electricity is growing all around the world and commands a larger share of the global energy supplies over time. The choice of fuels used to generate all this electricity has really a huge impact on the energy landscape going forward. Now, here we compare the cost of generating electricity from four major sources, and helps to explain why we see the mix for energy, electric power generation, to shift over time. Now, you'll notice on this chart, and by the way, these are all-in costs. They include capital costs, operating costs, and fuel costs, and this is for a typical startup of a new power generation station in 2030. And you'll see the coal is the most economically attractive fuel, followed by natural gas. And, of course, this explains why coal and gas today are used to generate most of the electricity in the world. Now, as you're about to see, however, these economics shift dramatically in countries where governments have policies to impose some form of a cost of carbon on various fuels. We take this same analytical approach, but we add a cost of carbon of about $60 a ton, which is about what we expect in the developed world around the year 2030. Coal becomes much less competitive compared with natural gas, and that's because of its higher carbon content per BTU of power. Nuclear and wind power become more attractive, which explains why we project strong growth for both of these sources. Now, while wind is renewable and produces no CO2 emissions, a chief drawback, of course, for wind is its intermittency, which limits its ability to provide reliable baseload power generation. The most likely fuel to help balance wind intermittency is natural gas. Now, on the right, we show electricity by fuel type. Even today, coal accounts for nearly half of the fuel used globally for electricity generation, but that's changing because of concerns about emissions. And this is not only CO2 emissions, but also sulfur, nitrogen oxides, and particulate emissions. After 2030, we see global coal demand declining for the first time in modern history. By 2004, coal's market share in the electricity sector will fall to about 33%. On the other hand, natural gas is gaining share. Natural gas is abundant and affordable. It burns up to 60% cleaner than coal. And also, gas-fired generation plants are based on proven technology that exists today. It can be built quickly and are cost-effective. By 2040, ExxonMobil expects natural gas to account for 30% of global electricity generation demand. Now, nuclear and renewables also grow, making up over 35% of electricity generation by 2040. Now, this chart helps to show why natural gas is growing so fast. Coal has unique environmental challenges given its higher carbon content and other air quality concerns. And both nuclear and wind are fundamentally limited in how fast that they can grow. And this is particularly true for nuclear post the Fukushima incident. This leaves gas the practical choice to fill the gap, as it's easy to build and it's very efficient. Now, to sum up the demand side, here's our picture of the primary energy types the world will use in 2040. Each bar represents a different fuel type in quadrillion BTUs per year, along with our projected average annual growth rate shown at the top of each bar. The dashed lines in each bar show the demand in the 2010. And I just want to make a few observations. First, note that oil, natural gas, and coal will remain the main energy sources. By 2040, they'll provide just under 80% of total energy, only slightly less than today. But among these three sources, there's a big shift. As the global drive towards cleaner fuels, natural gas will grow rapidly while coal begins to decline. You can see that the gas actually takes the number two spot in terms of being the second largest fuel, second only to oil. Coal usage is expected to actually fall slightly, marking the first long-term decline in coal demand since the start of the Industrial Revolution. Essentially, all the oil demand is tied to the transportation sector. Liquid fuels remain overwhelmingly the fuel of choice for consumers because of their convenience and energy density. Rising demand for commercial transportation, as we've already talked about, is the single biggest influence on oil demand through 2040. Looking to the right side of the chart, you'll notice that nuclear also grows significantly at about 2.2% a year. While still a substantial increase, we've lowered our projections this year for global nuclear growth in the aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear incident. Lastly, wind, solar, and biofuels are the fastest growing fuel sources, but even by 2040, they will account for only 4% of global energy demand, and that's compared to 1% today. Within these, wind is the fastest growing source, growing at about 8% a year. Now, as the world switches to less carbon-intensive fuels, we expect a significant slowdown in CO2 emissions. Emissions in developed countries, as well as China, will actually decline, even as economic output more than doubles. You can see that emissions grow in developing countries, shown here in red. And overall, we expect that global emissions will plateau between 2025 and 2040 as the world becomes more energy efficient and moves away from higher carbon-emitting fuels like coal. However, the story remains complex. When we talk about emissions, it's important also to look at emissions per capita because it provides important perspective. If you look to the right here, you see emissions per capita for several regions. We see the U.S. today clearly has the largest emissions per capita. And, of course, this is much higher because of living standards. Over the outlook, we expect per capita emissions to decline in the U.S. and Europe as their economies continue to become more efficient and switch to less carbon-intensive fuels. China's per capita emissions begin declining after 2030, and India's continue to rise. And, of course, even by 2040, there's still a huge gap in the difference of living standards in the developed and the developing world. So now let's shift to the supply side. Where are all these fuels going to come from? 100 years ago, of course, nearly all the world's energy came from wood and coal. And since that time, our energy choices have become cleaner and more diverse, and this trend will continue for the next 30 years. So let's take a look at each of these major sources of fuel, starting with oil. Now, here we show a chart of the supply outlook for liquid fuels. Liquid fuels category consists mostly of crude oil, either conventionally produced or from deep water or tight oil reserves. But today, a significant percentage of these come from oil sands, natural gas liquids, or NGLs on the chart, and biofuels, as you can see here. We project total liquids demand to rise to 112 million barrels per day in 2040. Now, most of this increase, as we've already discussed, is tied to the transportation sector. Again, liquid fuels provide the energy density and convenience that are critical for transportation. For crude oil, we expect to see a slight decline in conventional crude oil production over time. However, this decline will be more than offset by rising production of crude oil from deep water locations. Deep water production is expected to more than double. The success of deep water production is an example of how new technologies are the key to developing new sources of liquid fuels to meet rising demand. As you can see on the chart, deep water production was barely on the radar screen just 10 years ago, but by 2025, it will provide about 10% of global liquid fuels. The same is true for tight oil, which is growing as a result of recent advances in technology that have enabled our industry to unlock the oil found in shale and other tight rock formations. The advances are very similar to the ones that have enabled the growth in unconventional production of natural gas. And because of the increase in production of natural gas, we also show on this chart we're producing much more in liquids in the forms of natural gas liquids. By 2040, only about 60% of the world's liquid fuel supply will come from conventional crude oil production. The rest will be provided by deep water, tight oil, and NGLs, as well as oil sands and biofuels, all enabled by the continuing application of human ingenuity through technology. Now, while the composition of the world's liquid fuels are changing, one fact is not. The world continues to hold significant oil resources. You see on the far right here, the bar shows the world's oil resources in trillions of barrels. And you can see that even by 2040, ExxonMobil estimates that only about 45% of the world's recoverable oil will have been produced. The cumulative production through 2040 is not a far stretch from the crude oil that has been produced today, as is shown by the dashed white line. And just to emphasize how much oil we have in our outlook, at today's consumption level, today's oil resources represent over 100 years of supply. And remember, because of technology advances, estimates of oil resources keep growing over time. Now, decisions made decades ago to invest in technology, exploration, and development are critical to meeting today's global demands for liquid fuels. This plot illustrates that most of today's oil was discovered decades ago. Greater than 95% of today's oil was discovered before the year 2000, and with about three-quarters of today's production discovered before 1980. The industry continues to deploy new technologies to help revive aging fields. For example, ExxonMobil is using enhanced oil recovery methods to retrieve millions of barrels of additional oil from the Means field in Texas. That field was discovered in the 1930s, and it's already produced more than 300 million barrels. Another example is our work in the Upper Zakum field at Abu Dhabi. ExxonMobil, along with the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, is using various leading technologies such as artificial islands, extended reach drilling, and reservoir simulation to increase production by 50%. Now, as we've discussed, gas continues to be the growing fuel of choice in the outlook. And not only do we expect it to continue to gain share in the electricity generation sector, but it's also growing in industrial uses and in residential commercial applications. And this is made possible given the immense global natural gas resource. This chart shows global gas resources by region split into conventional and unconventional gas. The estimate of global remaining resource is over 28,000 trillion cubic feet. You could also characterize that as 28 quadrillion cubic feet, which translates into over 250 years of supply. About half the global resource is unconventional gas. In North America, unconventional gas accounts for approximately two-thirds of the resource. So you can see that gas is an abundant and very widespread resource. Now, this last chart that I have today shows the market share for fuels going back to 1850. Wood was the predominant fuel source going back to 1850, but to fuel the growth in industrialized economy, more energy was needed, and coal, thanks to improvement in mining technology, became a major fuel source. As transportation demand rapidly expanded, oil emerged as a new fuel, perfect for providing large quantities of energy in small volumes. Improvements in oil exploration technologies helped to keep pace with growing demand. Gas and hydroelectric power came about the same time to help meet growing power generation needs. Nuclear was introduced in the 70s, marking a meaningful appearance of a new modern source of energy. Today, renewables such as wind and solar are rapidly expanding, albeit from a small base. Oil, gas, and coal will continue to meet the majority of the world's energy needs through 2040, but we continue to see expansion and diversification of energy sources. The common theme is that as new fuels join the world mix, they take time to evolve and grow. And this evolution takes many decades. But the changes over time can lead to revolutionary impacts. Now, enabling this change requires tremendous levels of investment, sustained over decades, an unwavering drive for innovation and new technology, and reliable policies that promote a level playing field for pursuing all commercially viable energy solutions. We also need stable fiscal policies that support ongoing investments by the industry. Well, anyway, I'll just wrap up by saying that hopefully with this you can now better appreciate that the challenges we face as an industry and all of us face as a society to provide affordable and reliable energy to fuel improvement in living standards everywhere in the world. At the same time, ExxonMobil remains confident and optimistic both in our ability to deliver the energy the world needs and the potential for continued economic development and progress. I would say that at every point in time in history, the future looks daunting. Yet human creativity and ingenuity has always saved the day with innovation and hard work to achieve ever higher standards of living.
Thanks, Bill. And again, record time for a global energy presentation. And we'll now open it up for questions. And as a reminder, given the large online audience we'll have, we'll first allow questions here, take questions from those of you in the room. If you would, please, if you're not at the table, make sure you come up and use the mic so that the people that are participating online can hear the question as well. So, questions, yes. You have to open, yeah, turn it on.
Thank you.
And for the phone audience to ask a question, press star one to signal.
I'm Margaret Ryan with AOL Energy. I wondered if you could elucidate a little bit on the estimate that's on your slide, liquids supply continues to diversify. You have figures from, I think, IHS, you say here, of total remaining resources. Are we talking about economically recoverable resources? You're talking about resources we know how to get to, or does this include resources that are sitting in the ground, like at the bottoms of depleted wells, that we don't know how to get yet, but you think maybe someday we will?
Right.
I'm sorry.
We can. Laura, do you want to go back to the resource slide?
Yes.
Margaret, thanks for that question. I think it's a great question because in the oil business, where it's very easy to confuse people with all the resource estimates. There's proven reserves that are on people's accounting books, and there's resources. So, one of the reasons we decided to show resources here as opposed to proven reserves, is this is really, from an economist standpoint, what people expect really will be produced over time and that will be economic. If you look at just the amount of oil molecules in the world, believe it or not, you get a much larger number. So the question is, what do we really think will be produced over time? That doesn't mean that we are committed to developing all these yet. I mean, some of these are so far out in the future that no one has invested the money to produce these resources. So remember, as we develop the energy outlook, we're focused on what we really think is going to happen in the future. So we want to know about the oil that we think is going to be commercially viable, and that's really the key. And by the way, it's kind of an, as a side, not to get into the long version of this question, but it's interesting to me how the estimate of the world's resources have grown over time. If you go back in time to before 1950, everyone thought there was 1 trillion barrels in the world. By 1980, that grew to 1.7. The USGS in the year 2000 came out with an estimate of 3 trillion barrels. And now CERA has come out with their most recent outlook, and they estimate that there's 5 trillion. And this is really a technology story, because no one could imagine the kinds of things we could do today to efficiently and economically produce oil. So it's kind of a good news story in that regard.
Can I follow up on that really quickly?
Sure.
Adam Szymanski from Deutsche Bank. I like your question, Margaret. The total remaining resource base for liquids, how do you see, and looking at the page after that that shows the huge expansion in gas resources coming from improvements in technology there, how do you see the impact of tight oil developments on growing that remaining resource base? I mean, could this happen as quickly as it did in natural gas?
Adam, on the question of tight oil and shale oil and its ability to grow, the answer is yes. The potential is quite good there. I would say, in fact, that it's early days in estimating the levels of resources of tight oil. In fact, you've probably noticed that the range of estimates that are out there in the press are pretty wide. And so I would say our estimate is on the conservative side here. And in other places in the world, you won't find any published analyses of tight oil resources around the world because it's, again, such early days in estimating those resources. Until we get out there and actually try to develop those resources, it's hard to say. But the potential's there.
David?
David Pumphrey, CSIS, follow up on what I think is one of the headlines here, which is the decline in coal consumption out through this time period. And actually, it looks like your decline in coal consumption starts pretty early in the forecast period. To what extent is that driven by your assumption of carbon tax being put in place kind of in developed countries? And then how does that picture break down between developing countries and developed countries? So if I were, if I were the U.S. coal industry looking at that, would I assume that the decline in the U.S. is even sharper than perhaps that globalized number would look?
Yeah, David, a great question about what's really driving our outlook for coal. And while we did show a cost of carbon of $60 a ton, I want to emphasize that for us it's not a mechanical matter of just kind of rolling that into the equations and coming out with an answer based on that $60. And in fact, we look at it, it's a very granular outlook. The way we develop the outlook is on a country-by-country basis. We have this giant data model. We look at over 100 countries, country by country, looking at 15 different demand sectors, 20 different fuel types. And so you really have to handicap this for each and every country. And especially in the power generation sector, government policies can have huge impacts. I noticed just one dramatic example is look at just the two countries of France and Germany right next to each other and their different views on nuclear power. And so you can't use a formula to estimate what's going to happen in a country. So it varies. In the U.S., for example, when we look at, and the U.S. is a good example because we don't today have a hard cost for carbon. There's a lot of discussion what kinds of policies might come out in the future in the U.S. But so we assume in our outlook that for the U.S. that there will be no new coal plants built, but that the coal plants that are in use today will be shut down on what I'll call a reasonable schedule and consistent with the lives of those facilities. So it's a kind of what we call an economically reasonable approach. We're not suggesting that we're going to immediately shut down all coal plants and replace them with gas. but to kind of let this energy mix evolve over time. And I would say there's quite a strong agreement that that's probably a reasonable outlook for the U.S., even without a specific carbon tax or carbon cost policy regulations in place today. But again, it varies country by country. Now, when you ask about the developed world versus the developing world, you get quite a mix. For instance, coal for a while will continue to grow in China just because they need so much more electricity. They need to really use all different kinds, all forms of energy. But even China will see more growth in gas and nuclear. So it's very much a diverse outlook.
Yes, sir. Yes, if you could, please.
Robert Chiretta with International Investor. Let me ask to try to tie a few of those pieces together a little bit more. When I look at the chart called electricity demand, I don't see much of a drop-off in coal demand expectation. It seems to me that from about the year 2011 on to 2040, that looks pretty much the same amount to me. And going back to your CO2 emissions plateau, the only group that I see declining in terms of the emissions output would be the OECD nations. It looks like your outlook for the rest of the world is that their emissions will continue to grow throughout that period of time. The one strong conclusion I'm picking up from all this is that in all categories of all power generation and all types of energy, demand's going up, supply's going up, we're going to be using more of everything. So where's our CO2 emission, our carbon footprint look like in the future? It's growing, I guess, on all categories, is it not?
Yes, Robert. To answer, you asked several questions, but I'm going to start with where you concluded, which is emphasizing that we do show demand growing across the board. You know, overall, the world needs 30% more energy, and electric power generation is growing by 80%. Now, my remarks about coal declining, again, it's all relative. If you look on an absolute scale, you're absolutely right. The world is still going to use a lot of coal. And in fact, if you look at this chart, you can see that coal is growing from here into the future, and it isn't until after, I think, about 2025 that it begins to decline, but only in share, Robert. We're not saying that it goes away. Now, it depends, again, country by country, you see a very different picture here. But overall, the absolute level of coal is declining. But the reality is, I think that's your point, is this, the world still uses a lot of coal in the year 2040. And I think this is consistent with one of the key themes of our outlook, which is, you know, these sources of fuel can change only very slowly over time. It's hard, given the scale of the energy industry, it's hard to make abrupt changes. And it's not even economic for countries to do that. You spend all this money on a coal plant, for example, you can't expect people just to shut it down. Now, in the greenhouse gases, the reason that you've seen that the greenhouse gases reach a peak and then begin to decline is mainly because of the shift from coal to natural gas. So even though we're using more energy, we're displacing the high-carbon coal with natural gas.
And that, only in the
OECD
nations.
Correct. That's correct.
Right.
Yeah, and again, if you look at it in the developing world, although, again, it's very easy to point to the developing world as the, quote, the problem for CO2, but if you look at it on a per capita basis, these are people that are just trying to catch up with us. We already have our air conditioners and our refrigerators and our cars, and people around the world all want these same things. Now, fortunately, because of energy efficiency, we're able to continue to deliver all those good things, but at a lower and lower energy footprint.
Yeah. We're going to go around the horn.
Hi, Megan O'Sullivan from Harvard University. Thanks for this presentation. I'd like to ask you a question or two, going back to this slide, the liquid supply continues to diversify. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the geography behind these trends. So you've got different sources coming online, but what does this mean for the geographic pattern of production? Do you sign up to the new conventional wisdom that everything is shifting towards the Americas? And how much of your projections depend on Iraq meeting certain goals, and to what extent is it influenced by Saudi's recent decision not to build excess spare capacity beyond 12 million barrels?
Okay, Megan, I'll be happy to answer that question about the kind of geographic profile for energy supplies. It's kind of interesting that if you look from today and go out to the year 2040, the three top producers of oil will remain the same, and that's Saudi Arabia, Russia, and the United States. Now, there's a lot of other shifts in that mix. You see a lot of deep water growth in Brazil, for example, and yes, we do expect that Iraq will continue to grow and producing oil. Tight oil and shale oil will continue to grow. And the U.S. is actually quite a good news story in that we actually believe that oil imports have reached a peak in the United States and that we will see a steady decline in oil imports, and that's mainly as oil continues to grow in the lower 48 and with oil sands in Canada. And part of that is the tight oil or the shale oil story. People talk a lot about the industry moving back to the Americas, and I would say the industry always moves wherever the oil is. And the fact is now, because all these new resources can be developed economically, it's natural that the industry is producing these resources. If you look at North America, so if I kind of wrap in the U.S. and Canada together, by 2040, we show imports down to almost zero. I think our estimate is actually 1 million barrels a day.
Could I just follow up and ask, sure, are you able to tell us what your Iraq projection is? And again, are you assuming Saudi Arabia doesn't build its spare capacity beyond where it is today?
Well, we do look at energy production country by country, but mainly we tend to look at capacity because we not only want to make sure that there's enough production available at any time, but we like to see spare capacity of 5 to 10% at any given time because of geopolitical events. Of course, this is a great year to talk about this, and we've seen what happened when a country like Libya has problems and goes offline, and the fact is the industry was able to fill that gap because it has spare capacity. So yes, in your specific question about Saudi Arabia, we do expect that they will continue to have significant surplus capacity. They have capacity of about 12 million barrels a day, and we expect that they'll remain at that level even beyond what they're exporting. On Iraq, we expect that the volumes will continue to grow. We focus more on their capacity over time. I'd frankly rather not get into any details of the numbers for production, because to us it doesn't matter so much. We just want to make sure the capacity is there. Where it actually flows in 2040 could be driven by a variety of factors.
Yeah. And policy, maybe. Just one addition to Bill's comments. Policy will play a big role. For example, here in North America, the discussion about the Keystone Pipeline, discussion about fracking, discussion about the billions and billions of barrels that are currently known to exist but offline to the industry, whether it's on the Western OCS or the Eastern OCS or in the Arctic areas. So policy will play a these resources will come on in a lumpy trajectory, not a straight line, but the resources are available.
Thank you. This is Sara Bakshiri, independent consultant. I used to work with NIOC, so Iran is always my concern. Just to continue her question, with the great resources that we're expecting from Iraq and the shale gas in U.S., do you think Iran resources are matter significantly for the whole global energy supply in future, or the lack of investment and sanction in Iran wouldn't harm the global energy supply in the midterm significantly?
Well, certainly, as someone in the oil industry, we would say all barrels matter, okay? And every country matters, not only for us, but frankly to the people who live in that country. And I think that the development of oil resources and people's well-being go hand in hand. This is clearly the development of oil resources is a win-win opportunity for the people of Iran or any country. And so at the same time, the geopolitical overlay on any country can get pretty complicated. And that's why in our outlook, we're kind of aware of all those challenges, and we try to handicap the production and the capacities for each country based on what we know. But I would say that over the long term, we're optimistic that those barrels will flow and that, as Ken mentioned, that the government will develop policies that are consistent with economic growth in Iran.
Supply that Iran oil doesn't come out actually because of some kind of those that they're very positive that Iran can have the expected production, there's going to be some kind of supply shock. And I just want to know that, is that what you see, that Iran's oil could fall? I mean, it's better not to.
You know, honestly, I feel like that's getting into political questions. I think we all know that there's lots of different scenarios of what could happen in the Middle East. And that's one of the reasons why we think it's important the world have surplus capacity. And so, again, we're optimistic that over time the world, the oil will keep flowing.
What, we'll take one more question from the room, and then we have a choke point. And Jim, we'll get to you. But with choke point on the online, I can feel it in the back.
Hi, Luvian Myers, Goldman Global Strategies. I was wondering if you could touch a little bit on global trade and specifically new exporters that are coming online. I'm thinking particularly of U.S. LNG exports that may impact global supply and demand.
Okay, thank you. To talk a little bit about trade, we have, as you might imagine, a very strong view that trade is good. And I say that because we often hear talk about wanting to restrain trade for various reasons. And to me, it's kind of an economics 101. When you take economics, the first thing they teach you is trade is a positive sum game. Countries pursue trade for the benefit of both parties. And so, you know, we always are positive in terms of trade and global investment. On the more specific question on U.S. LNG, I know there's a lot of talk about that right now. ExxonMobil is currently not exporting LNG. We don't have any specific plans to do that. We know that people are looking at that. And I think, again, it's good for people to be considering all options. The world has a lot of oil and gas, and how that moves around the world is really driven by economics that people pursue for the mutual interests of the countries involved. We import a lot of oil today in the U.S. because it's to the benefit of the U.S. economy. It helps the U.S. to be competitive, to use the lowest cost forms of energy available to it, whether it's domestic or imported oil. Could we have more domestic oil in the U.S.? Yes, if more resources were made available to us, we could have even lower greater access to affordable supplies in the U.S. So anyway, we're very pro-trade, and we think it's something that ought to be considered, and you know, subject to whatever kind of reasonable government policies we think make sense, but we're pro-trade.
Okay. Jim?
Jim Landers of the Dallas Morning News. Your comments about North America in the future and lumping Canada in with the United States, did I hear that right, that we would see a decline to 1 million barrels a day or less of oil imports? And are you considering Mexico in that equation as well?
If you look, what I said is that if you look at the U.S. alone, you will see imports continue to decline. But if you look at North America, including Canada, yes, we show those imports declining to almost zero. I say almost zero because it's almost too close to call. The actual number we have in the outlook is 1 million barrels a day of imports. Now, when you look at the Americas, I expand now to all of the Americas, we actually are surplus. We've actually become exporters, and that's including Venezuela and Colombia, including all of the Americas.
Just to clarify, that's under an unrestrained scenario, though, in terms of Arctic, offshore,
right.
Onshore, unconventional.
Right. Unconstrained.
Take a few. All right, we're ready for some on.
Yes.
We'll take a few questions on the phones.
And again, that was star one for phone questions, and we'll go first to Chris Kahn.
Hi, everybody. Chris Kahn with the AP.
Hey, Chris.
I wanted to ask if you could just tell us on what you're basing your forecast for those hybrid vehicles. If you could explain how its market share goes from 1 to 50%.
Okay, the question is on what we base our estimate for the growth in hybrids. Well, we always start in our outlook with what makes economic sense for consumers. And if you just start with a clean piece of paper, over the future, what people would do is they would continue to buy, or the auto companies would continue to make more and more efficient vehicles over time, but probably the fleet would be larger than what we anticipate, because separately from what consumers want is you also have these government mandates on fuel efficiencies, which are really forcing the car companies to make cars more efficient than they probably otherwise would. And this is just because of consumer preferences. The reality is consumers will only pay so much for fuel efficiency, and they tend to like larger cars. And you can see this just in the U.S. if you go outside and look at the profile of a typical car. And so we, for the Energy Outlook, our challenge is to say, well, how are we going to achieve these mandates by governments around the world, particularly in the developed world, to achieve higher efficiencies? And our view is conventional gasoline and diesel technology could almost get there, but not quite. So we say, okay, well, what's the next increment of efficiencies that we could capture, again, that makes sense for consumers? And see, today, hybrids are actually, as you probably know, more expensive than a conventional car. And this is why the market deployment of those cars has been quite low. Is if you sit down and look at the added cost for the car versus the fuel savings, it's hard for it to make sense to someone who's looking at just the dollars and cents. But we think that it's not that much more to pay, and the consumers will be willing to pursue, will buy hybrids in order to achieve the overall efficiency mandates that the government has set. And that's versus other alternatives. If you look at electric cars, for example, the added cost for electric cars is huge. You know, it almost doubles the cost of the vehicle. So even though you have fuel savings, you're never going to get a payout from a consumer standpoint. And so, and I like to say hybrids are just kind of the best of both. You have a little bit of electricity and you have a little bit of conventional. Sometimes in the real world, something in between the two extremes is what makes sense. Yes, sir.
I should know. Yeah, it's okay. And we'll take our next question from Karen Bowman.
Good morning. Thanks for hosting this conference call. I have a question regarding carbon capture and storage projects. You had mentioned while the percentage of, of coal being used will decline, it's still going to be in the energy mix. So do you still see a place for carbon capture and storage projects in the future? And if so, what do you think needs to be done to, move these projects along?
Well, Karen, thanks for the question about carbon capture and storage or sequestration, which is something that we look at. This is, for those who don't know what that is, this is for instance, with an electric power generation plant. You can have a coal plant, with the issue being carbon dioxide emissions. You actually chemically capture those emissions, separate out the CO2 stream, and then pipeline it to some underground storage location, and you kind of sequester the CO2, and so you don't have net CO2 emissions. Our view is that the costs to do that are pretty high. Most people would say it's $80 to $100 a ton of CO2. We don't see the world being willing to pay that much to mitigate CO2 emissions, even by the year 2040. It's actually getting close by the year 2040 that you might see CCS come onto the scene. It also requires a lot of power generation to run that capture facility. So you have to build about a power plant about one-third larger. You need one-third more power just to run the capture facility. So it's very costly. And it becomes, at that point, the issue of, you know, the alternatives with nuclear, for instance. Nuclear starts to look more attractive. And also, if you're looking at coal versus gas, you know you can do the same thing with a gas-fired power plant. So actually, if you want to do carbon capture and storage, it's much cheaper to do it on a gas-fired power station because obviously you have less carbon to capture. And so in our outlook, you'd actually have CCS come in for gas-fired power generation before you would for coal.
Okay.
One more on the phone.
We'll take a question from Ruth Liao.
Yes, thanks for your presentation. I'd like to go back to your estimate that 15% of global gas demand will be met by LNG in 2040. Can you go a little bit more into detail on that figure and what percentage you think will come from the U.S.? Thank you.
I'm sorry, 50% of?
15% of global gas demand will be met by LNG in 2040?
Yeah, 15% of gas will be met by LNG. You know, LNG is already used extensively, particularly out in the Far East, where you have LNG being produced in Indonesia and Malaysia and Australia, places like Japan and Korea. Almost all the gas that they burn comes from LNG. And we see continued growth in LNG. It's a very competitive source of gas. But particularly for Europe and for the Far East, you do not see only a small layer of LNG coming into the U.S., and this is really just to meet seasonal gas demands as you get into pipeline constraints and gas moving from places like Texas up to New York. So we do show a little bit of LNG coming into the U.S., And, you know, of course, the LNG technology has kind of revolutionized the gas world. In the old days, when you found gas, you had to hook it up to the demand with a pipeline. And now, with LNG plants in the Middle East and in the Far East, you can find gas anywhere, liquefy it, put it in ships, and distribute it anywhere in the world. So it's incredibly flexible and convenient and cost competitive.
Open the floor again to the room here.
Thanks. Ben Lando with the Iraq Oil Report. The IEA predicts that Iraq will be the single greatest source of new oil over the coming decades. And I'm wondering if you all agree with that, because it seems that your estimates have it lower than both the IEA and Iraq's estimates for their production over the coming decades. And second to that, what role do you think Iraqi Kurdistan will play in global supply?
And talking about Iraq, first of all, I didn't mention what our outlook had in terms of production for Iraq. And I would say, first of all, there's no question that the growth in oil from Iraq will play a very significant role in meeting the world's crude demands, and it'll be a key part of the production. And I think there's huge potential there. I think the actual rates will be determined by many factors, and as Ken mentioned, not the least of those is the political developments and the fiscal structure in Iraq and other places. And so, yes, by all means, it will be a large part. By the way, we look at the IEA outlooks. We always like to compare with what others are saying. We're actually quite pleased with the alignment that we get with the other outlooks. And, you know, some of the key themes, the IEA also says that oil, gas, and coal will be the primary sources of fuel in the future. The world will become more energy efficient. And they also show a big shift to natural gas. So we tend to be quite consistent with the IEA.
Just to go back, just to make sure I didn't hear you wrong, but you said that you think the three top producers will remain the three top producers going forward. Right. But Iraq's projections for what they're going to produce is they'll be the number one producer in, you know, 7 to 10 years. And so, I mean, inherently, you disagree with that projection.
Sure. Well, you know, I'd have to go back and look at our list, you know, who is number 4, 5, and 6. I remember Canada, for example, comes into the top five by the year 2040. But I really don't want to get overly focused on Iraq production rates in the context of just the global energy demand pictures. Again, Iraq, again, is a very much a good news story, and I think that everyone will appreciate the benefits that come from continued growth in oil production, and there's varied estimates on how high that can go.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of new production, Iraqi Kurdistan?
No, I don't really want to talk about Kurdistan today. But thank you. But thank you for asking.
Natalia Yegorova, CSIS. You mentioned quickly the Arctic region. What is your perspective on the role of the Arctic in the global production?
Yeah, Arctic is, again, a great technology story. You know, we're doing things in Arctic regions now that are incredible by standards of 20 or 30 years ago. And we already, ExxonMobil has operations today in Arctic areas, so we're quite optimistic about the potential to develop those areas. You've probably seen our recently announced venture in Russia developing Arctic resources, and they are included in our outlook. I think the most you can say about Arctic is just a lot of upside there. Again, there's always a bit of inherent conservatism when we look at oil resources, but as we continue to develop Arctic resources and get more information, there's probably even more upside there. So they will clearly play a role in meeting future energy demands.
Hi, thank you. Lynn Garner with BNA. I just want to ask you about the transportation demand chart.
Right.
Assuming that 90% of transportation will still run on petroleum-based fuels by 2040, that just seemed high to me. What about what the alternatives? I thought maybe they would have a bigger role. And what about natural gas in fleets? And how do you assume that? Make that assumption.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about alternatives in transportation. And you're right, we show essentially all transportation being fueled by oil just because, again, it just makes so much sense for consumers. The technology is just hard to beat. specifically on the question of natural gas for vehicles. For those of you who don't know, you actually could pretty easily take a conventional engine and burn natural gas in it. And the usual way they do that is by using compressed natural gas. You can actually also use LNG, but typically it's compressed natural gas at 3,600 pounds. You have to put this high-pressure tank in your trunk. Right away, it has less range because you have lower fuel density. Again, liquids have very high energy density, so you have less energy density. So if you put a big enough tank in, you can probably get about 60% of the range of a gasoline car, which isn't bad, so I think it's feasible for some consumers. The big issue are the costs for putting those tanks in. In total, we estimate it costs about $5,000 more in terms of the added price to a car to put in compressed natural gas. And again, if you look at the fuel savings over time, most consumers will calculate that they just can't justify that. Now, please bear in mind, you know, we're the country's largest supplier of natural gas. We'd love to have an opportunity to sell more natural gas. But in our outlook, we'll always have to come back to what makes sense for consumers. Now, we think there'll be niche opportunities for natural gas to transportation. And the example that always I like to use is fleets. Think of delivery trucks that come back to the same depot every night. They can probably afford to build a natural gas distribution facility at the depot so that they all, and they don't have to necessarily have the range capabilities that consumers might want, and so they can come back and use natural gas and fill up every night. It may make sense. And so we would say, you know, the message for us is let the markets work. Consumers today can choose natural gas to fuel their vehicles if they want. We just don't think it makes economic sense. And so, you know, we are big believers that, you know, we shouldn't have subsidies for any forms of energy, just let the markets decide. And so our view is the natural gas to transportation will remain kind of a niche opportunities.
Well, Ken and Bill, I want to thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. I must admit, it probably was a world record presentation for a long-term outlook and your openness with questions. So please join me in thanking them for their participation.